Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning. I'm Sarah Gonzalez. I'm a reporter at WNYC, and I'm filling in for Brian. Today, we're talking about a new discovery about a disease that one in three adults die from in the U.S., Alzheimer's. We're looking at all the ways public education could change under the Trump administration. And Latinos are the fastest growing group within Islam. But first, the Trump children's many hats. The complex nature of U.S. foreign policy usually leads incoming presidents to lean heavily on the State Department for guidance in the early days of a new administration. But in the case of President-elect Donald Trump, his approach has been much like his campaign in that he's surrounded himself with members of his inner circle, specifically his family, in his early dealings with global affairs. You may have heard that the president-elect's daughter, Ivanka Trump, sat in on a meeting he had with the Japanese prime minister last month. According to the Wall Street Journal, Trump's oldest son, Donald Trump Jr., held private discussions with pro-Russian figures about cooperating with Russia to end the war in Syria. And the president-elect has suggested that his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, could mediate the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Nahal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent at Politico, is here to talk about the formal and informal ways President-elect Trump's children may be representing America and the Trump brand overseas. She spoke to several officials at the State Department for her story, Trump's Kids Diplomatic Forays Rattle State Department. Nahal, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with a little bit of some Trump transition team news. The Trump transition team has confirmed that the Republican governor of Iowa, Terry Branstad, has accepted the job of U.S. ambassador to China. This after Trump sort of rattled relations with China last week when he spoke directly to the president of Taiwan, breaking decades-old U.S. protocol. What does Branstad's appointment tell us about the kind of relationship that Trump plans to have with China, which he has said we have unfair trade deals with?
Well, it's really interesting because Branstad has fairly extensive ties to China. He's friends with the Chinese president, Xi Jinping. And it's one of those things that's a good sign. If I was China right now, I'd be a bit happy, thinking, well, this is somebody who understands us, who understands the value of trade. He's also someone who is an executive in his own state. So he kind of knows how to run an organization and has some skills that could translate into the diplomatic world. So after the Taiwan call in particular, this in some ways could be a good sign for the Chinese-U.S. relations.
And when Trump spoke with the president of Taiwan, you know, which upset China, the president-elect sort of tried to downplay the call, making it seem like it was more of a courtesy call. But an article in the New York Times yesterday suggests that former Senator Bob Dole, who is now a lobbyist working with the government of Taiwan, has been working for months behind the scenes to get these two to have a phone conversation.
Yes, it seems that Bob Dole has been working to try to get contacts between the Trump team, his advisors, and the Taiwanese government going. Whether, you know, it seems that basically the Taiwanese thought, look, we're going to have a new president coming in. He, you know, perhaps is a bit more hostile to China than others have been in the past, and maybe we can take advantage of this. Now, at the end of the day, you know, it's a congratulatory call. We don't really know exactly what was discussed, but it's unlikely that they talked made any sort of serious policy decisions or anything on this phone call. So the Chinese, while they, of course, are unhappy about it and upset, they probably are thinking, you know what, let's just hold on to this for a while. Let's not overreact to where this is going to lead. And Dole's involvement is really fascinating because, yeah, I mean, his firm got paid a significant amount of money to do this and set up these calls and conversations and this relationship. But at the same time, you know, he's a lobbyist. He's doing his job. So it's kind of how Washington works in a way.
And do we know how China has reacted to the news that this was an orchestrated call between the president-elect and the president of Taiwan?
Well, the Chinese, you know, let's not forget Trump himself was kind of made it seem like it wasn't necessarily that orchestrated. So part of it has been just some mixed messages. So far, the Chinese have basically lodged a protest with the U.S. government. The administration, the Obama administration, has said, look, our policy has not changed. And it's just one of those things, I think, where the Chinese are just going to kind of wait and see for a while.
Okay, and listeners, if anyone wants to get in on this conversation, give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. We are speaking with Politico Foreign Affairs correspondent Nihal Tusi. Nihal, I want to ask you, can you just to take a step back, tell us again, like, what is the major break in policy in Donald Trump's phone call with Taiwan? Like, why is it a problem that he did that?
Well, the United States has not had formal diplomatic relations with China, with Taiwan since 1979. We have a one-China policy, which kind of recognizes this idea that the Chinese government is the one that we should be dealing with, not the Taiwanese government. And so it's been like four decades since our president has spoken to the president of Taiwan. In fact, when U.S. diplomats refer to the government of Taiwan or the leader of Taiwan, they often say the president on Taiwan instead of the president of Taiwan. So it's something that's extremely sensitive. And so for Trump to actually speak to the Taiwanese leader in and of itself was precedent-breaking.
And there may be a pattern of behavior here, and I'm interested to get your take on this. Everyone sort of assumed that the president-elect's call to Taiwan was a mistake made out of ignorance and inexperience, but it turned out that it wasn't. And I'm wondering if the president-elect is using his perceived ignorance to his advantage a little bit. I mean, for example, in your story, you mentioned that Donald Trump isn't consulting with the State Department. And so the perception that he's sort of bound to make a there's a perception that he's sort of bound to make a mistake. What do you think about that?
Well, I think at this stage, he's really appreciating being unpredictable. In fact, it's something that through the campaign, he said he wanted to be unpredictable. He wanted to keep people on their toes. And so far, because he's still only the president-elect, other countries are probably just thinking, okay, let's just still wait and see. Now, when he becomes president, takes that oath, and if he takes steps like this, we might see much bigger repercussions. The Chinese, instead of lodging a complaint with the Obama administration, might actually, say, cancel some sort of a diplomatic event with Trump's people. There's all sorts of things that could happen once he actually becomes president. And this whole thing about, I don't know or I don't care, it's not going to play as well once he takes the oath of office.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I want to move on to Trump's children for now. With no substantial foreign policy experience and their involvement in their father's global business, representing plenty of opportunities for conflicts of interest, the Trump children have raised some serious concerns with the State Department over their potential role as you call them, freelance ambassadors. What have you been hearing from State Department officials?
Well, they're very concerned. They're not absolutely freaking out yet, but they're growing increasingly worried. They're looking at the future and they're thinking, look, Trump is very close to his children. He has this business in which his adult kids are executive vice presidents, and he has a son-in-law that he has suggested maybe could try to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian crisis. And they're asking themselves, well, not only that, but also he hasn't taken a State Department briefing yet. He acts like the Foreign Service isn't even there to a degree. And so they're all these frustrations are coming together, and they're thinking, look, if one day Ivanka Trump goes on a visit to Japan and, has for business reasons even, is it possible that some Japanese leader may go up to her and whisper something in her ear in the hopes that it could reach President Trump and could affect U.S. policy, and the State Department might be cut out of it? And they're just worried about the confusion that could arise. They're worried about being taken advantage of. They're also kind of concerned about the ethics of it all. And it's very much kind of new ground for people, because it's rare to have this type of family in the White House where the business and the diplomatic areas overlap so much.
And I'm curious, do anti-nepotism laws not prevent Trump's children from taking meetings with foreign leaders?
Well, as long as they're informal advisors, like if they're not on the books as having a particular kind of job, it's hard to see how anti-nepotism laws would affect it. Those laws are written in a way that, you know, can be read in different ways and interpreted in different ways. Let's not forget that when, during the Bush administration, for instance, Vice President Dick Cheney's daughter was an official in the State Department. So to a degree, you know, some of these things can be allowed, and then at a certain point it might be crossing the line. But as long as they're not paid, a president can rely on them to convey a message to someone that he wants to reach out to quietly, perhaps. And by the way, it's not, historically speaking, presidents and diplomats have often done this. They've relied on informal envoys. The difference, though, is that, you know, they usually keep the Foreign Service in the loop. So say, for instance, the president wants to send a friend to meet with somebody quietly. The ambassador might go with him. But in this case, if they're just kind of doing it on their own or doing it inadvertently because they're on a business trip and leaving impressions that the State Department isn't prepared to deal with, then that could lead to a lot of confusion.
And I want to get to that a little bit more in a second, but first I want to go to some callers and listeners. We're talking about the many hats that President-elect Trump's children wear. Give us a call if you have a question for Politico, a foreign affairs correspondent, Nihal Tusi, 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. And right now I want to go to Rita in the Upper West Side. Rita, you're on WNYC.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much. very good show. Actually, your guest just covered a part of my suggestion, but I have a very simple suggestion, which is that we not refer to Trump's children as children because it makes them sound too benign, and to emphasize the point that your guest was just making, that these people are all vice presidents or presidents of divisions, and so we should refer to them as by those titles so that the American people know that Donald Trump's interests, business interests, are marching across the world through his children. And I won't repeat everything that the guest just said, but and then therefore having this untoward influence.
All right. Thank you for your call, Rita. Now I want to go to Bill in Darien, Connecticut. Bill, you're on WNYC.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Just a couple of points. First off, the tone of the interview, and, you know, it's an interesting interview, but the tone, actually both of you, and I don't know if it's any fault or for whatever, that by him departing from sort of State Department protocol, and sort of past practices and so forth is a bad thing. I mean, quite frankly, can you name a significant victory in the State Department in either administration, either the Bush two terms or the Obama two terms? It has been horrific. This is a man who has gone around the world, built a very impressive business, knows world leaders either directly or indirectly, knows a few things about other countries, and chose to take a different track. The consternation over his selection of the State Department is just, to me, is just unbelievably ridiculous. The man has only been president-elect for, what, 5-6 weeks? He's another 6 weeks away from taking office. Yes, is foreign policy important? Yes, absolutely, because of the many, many, many failures over these last two presidencies. That's my comment.
Bill, I want you to stay on the line for a second. Nihal, I'm wondering if you can respond to this. You write in your piece that, you know, speaking to the point that Donald Trump has not taken any briefings with the State Department, you write that people at the State Department doubt whether President-elect Donald Trump knows that there are 75,000 trained, paid diplomats around the world who are paid to carry out the president's agenda, whoever the president is. Do you want to respond to Bill?
Yes. No, I think what he's saying is really interesting because there is this strain of thought that maybe it is time to shake things up. Maybe it is time to do things differently. Now, in terms of victories that diplomats have had over the last several years, I mean, it depends on your political perspective. But there are some who would argue that the Obama administration's Iran nuclear deal was a good thing and that diplomacy was something that won out in that. There are others who say that the diplomatic opening to Cuba was a huge, huge accomplishment. Those are just some examples of climate deals, other things. The fact that even during the Bush administration, the fact that they were able to get so many different countries involved in a coalition in Afghanistan as well as in Iraq. Now you have, you know, your different viewpoints on whether the Iraq war was worth it or not, but the fact that they were able to do that, some would say was a victory of diplomacy. So, yeah, I mean, there are these people out there who are working often anonymously to get a lot of things done, many things of which we never hear about.
Go ahead, Bill.
Go ahead.
Okay. 75,000 employees at the State Department, and, you know, you may... If you were a more liberal persuasion, you would think things like climate deal and opening Cuban or so forth are good. I'm obviously not of that persuasion. I'm conservative, and I think that, you know, from the perspective of, sort of Trump's base, the American worker, these things are bad. They're not good.
Bill, I'm wondering,
if you've got 75,000 people who are inclined toward a direction that the Trump base does not feel is good, of course you're not going to pay any attention to them, and you're probably looking to replace a good number of them.
Bill, do you not think that it could be a good idea for the president-elect to get briefed on U.S. relations with a certain foreign country before taking meetings with them? Like, do you not see how that might be valuable?
Well, I mean, yes, of course, but I mean, understand this. You're in the process of formulating a cabinet. You know, what happens on the streets of Havana right now is not exactly, you know, high on your priority list. He is trying to put together a cabinet so that when day one comes, he can have it in place. And, you know, obviously you want someone who agrees with you, at least in principle, about, you know, Cuba or Iran or climate change or whatever. So sitting around talking to a bunch of State Department people, I think is of very little use at this point.
Okay, well, thank you for your call.
If I could say something about that. Well, just because you're president-elect does not mean that the world has stopped moving. Mm-hmm. Something that does happen in Havana right now might actually have a tremendous impact on your presidency in a few months. The September 11th plotters plotted for years. They didn't just begin plotting after George W. Bush took office. Trump not only has not taken State Department briefings, he's also been skipping intelligence briefs. And that, in particular, is alarming to people in the intelligence community because they say he needs to know what's happening before he takes office. So, look, you know, whether you think diplomats are valuable or not, it's a whole different thing. But the fact is that they are there. And I just want to clarify one thing about the 75,000 figure. That is everybody that the State Department employs. That includes, like, local linguists and staffers that are not officially diplomats. And it includes tech people. It's a very big number, but it's actually, when you divide it up, it's different, different factions within it. I just want to be clear about that.
Okay, thanks. And I want to go to another caller, Jerry in Fairfield, Connecticut. You're on WNYC.
Hello.
Hello.
My comment is pretty simply, I mean, I appreciate the media's delicacy in handling the transition of Mr. Trump. However, I just... In the back of my mind, I feel like it's in a monarchy he's approaching, appointing his children and ignoring years of diplomatic structure. I just don't understand. I mean, as your expert just said, it's an extremely complex world. Now, granted, Mr. Trump has experience in buying and selling real estate internationally, but beyond that, I can't fathom his approaching, you know, the future without the support of very important people who have an enormous amount of information and knowledge to share with him. I don't care whether you're a conservative or a Democrat. The world, as your commenter just said, keeps marching forward, and, you know, it's just humongously complex.
Nihal, you have written that it's not so uncommon for the children of U.S. presidents to get jobs in the administration. And you've also said that presidents have handed out ambassadorships sort of as rewards to campaign donors and friends. What is the difference between that and what we're seeing with Donald Trump's children, adult children?
Well, you know, again, there are specific laws and regulations that govern, like, kind of a lot of these appointments, and I don't want to make a broad statement that says, you know, one thing can happen or another thing never can. It just kind of depends on the situation and the exact circumstance. But that being said, yes, I mean, handing out ambassadorships to political donors is very common, and these types of things can, you know, come in handy down the line. But the difference is that ultimately for a lot of people who say you're in the diplomatic corps or whatever, that is your job full time. And if you're like a foreign leader and you want to find out what's going on, you're often going to turn to the ambassador of the United States in your country or their envoys. And it's going to be tough if those people feel like they don't even know what's going on because they're confused about the policies that the president is putting out there. Now, as far as Trump's adult children, you know, he hasn't said he's going to appoint any of them to any official positions or anything like that. I mean, that's, he said, well, maybe, you know, Jared Kushner, my son-in-law, could help out on this peace process. And maybe he's had Ivanka sit in on some stuff. But the thing that's important to remember is even if they're not in an official position, because of these business interests, other countries might look at them and say, you know what, that's one way to get closer to the president is to reach out to their children. They might come here for a visit to their golf course or their hotel or whatever, and maybe I can get a word in through my own emissary about what I want to see happen. So it's not that it's necessarily going to be some intentional thing. It's more about the unintentional impacts. The fact that they're just simply going to be traveling and going to be in different places and could be viewed as a channel to the president.
And the president-elect has announced on Twitter that he will hold a news conference with his children next week, December 15th, to talk about turning over some of his business operations to his children. Let's say that he formally turns over operations. Does that address all of the potential conflict of interest?
Well, conflict of interest, you know, on a legal term in terms of diplomacy, you know, perhaps it might, because they'll just say, look, we're just business folks and we're not doing diplomacy. But in terms of perception, that's a whole different thing. In terms of what people just simply view of Ivanka or Eric Trump or Donald Trump Jr. as doing and as potentially being their channel to the president, it's a whole different matter. So there's conflicts of interest in terms of the law, and then there's those in terms of just what people view and what people see. And that's really important because, frankly, in diplomacy overseas, perception matters sometimes more than reality.
Okay, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about the role of President-elect Donald Trump's children on The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Sarah Gonzalez filling in for Brian, and we're speaking with Nihal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent at Politico. I want to go to another caller, Justin in the West Village. Justin has a question about Ivanka's meeting with the Prime Minister of Japan. Justin, welcome to WNYC.
Hi, good morning, ladies. Sorry, I'm a little under the weather, so you have to forgive me.
What is your question?
It's more of a, I guess it's a question and a combination on a comment as well. But when President-elect Donald Trump met with the Prime Minister Abe of Japan, almost exactly at the same time, there was a meeting going on, and New York Times actually covered this story first. With Ivanka Trump's shoe company and a big licensed manufacturer in Japan, the biggest stakeholder, STI, which is what it's called, has the largest investor, and that backer and investor is actually the Japanese bank, which is owned by the government. So while that was happening in Japan, she was sitting in the meeting with the Prime Minister. So I guess my question is obviously there's kind of a conflict of interest, but if this kind of pattern continues, like, what are the ramifications and what are things that you could do to essentially stop it, if any, because it's clearly kind of a conflict of interest.
Nihal?
Yeah, this is one of the big concerns. It's something that people are, ethicists, lawyers, they're kind of scratching their heads over because to a degree it's somewhat uncharted territory, again, to have this type of a person who's so invested in his businesses also be president. And yes, Ivanka Trump met with the Japanese prime minister at the same time that she was nearing a licensing deal with a Japanese company whose parent has a stake by the Japanese government. So there is this situation. Now, whether she said anything to Shinzo Abe, the Japanese prime minister, about her clothing line, we don't know, and who knows. But the fact is that if you want to impress Donald Trump, you might want to impress his kids now. And one of the things that's, you know, in terms of perception is we're seeing an increasing number of foreign governments trying to host events at the Trump Hotel here in Washington, D.C. And, you know, legally they might be perfectly allowed to do that. But does it look good? Does it send a signal? Are they trying to send a signal? That's a whole different question. I mean, this is the type of thing that, you know, I'm hoping that me, myself, and other reporters are going to be looking into extensively over the next few years, because I don't think that even with this December 15th press conference that the questions are going to go away.
Okay, and I want to go to, I think we have time for one more caller, Bob in Queens. Bob, you're on WNYC.
Yeah, hi, how you doing? Great show. What I'd like to say is, you know, Mr. Trump, I'm sure he realizes, I think there's 2 million federal employees that, of course, I sense that it's probably bloated. It seems to me that Mr. Trump, he's basically going to get on the phone, do things. He doesn't need 75,000 people doing things when he could basically call the prime minister, hey, let's work out a deal. I think people are going to see that for the next 4 years. He's a CEO president, and it's going to be absolutely, totally different ever before in the history of the United States.
Nahal?
Yeah. You know, when he's been vetting candidates for Secretary of State, and one of the things that his aides have told us is he wants somebody who can make great deals, because to him, to Trump, from what we can tell, he really views diplomacy and foreign policy as transactional. You know, we'll do something for you if you do something for us. But that's not necessarily how it always works. Sometimes there are countries that want certain things that we're not going to want to give them. And if we don't give them those things, they can actually make our lives very, very difficult. And we have very little leverage to make them stop. It's the type of thing where a lot of people in the diplomatic world, they say, look, transactional diplomacy isn't necessarily the safest thing, because it just erodes the idea of alliances that can withstand fissures and changes over time. And so it's this thing, it's a very, when you look also at the people that Mr. Trump is considering for Secretary of State, you see there's a lot of contradictions on their own positions. Some of them, for instance, love Russia. Others think Russia is a major threat. So Mr. Trump is trying to figure out his own view of the world, and so far there have been a lot of contradictory signals being sent. And when you're a country overseas and you're thinking, okay, well, we're going to have a new president in the United States, and I'm not going to be able to predict what he's going to do, and what I want is stability and predictability, then you might hedge your bets, and you might turn to other powers. You might turn to China. You might turn to Russia and say, you know what, maybe I need to have you on my side, because I don't know what President Trump is going to want of me or ask of me, and if he does ask me of something, I don't know if I can deliver it for him. So I need a backup.
All right. I think we're going to leave it there. Nahal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent at Politico, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Coming up, a new discovery in Alzheimer's disease. Stay with us.